This week on Lunchbox Envy, there's one for every 7 people on Earth.
In the UK alone, we switch 200 of them on every second.
But before they arrived in our kitchens, they were used to reanimate frozen hamsters.
It's microwaves.
Microwaves.
Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Manu. Hello, Manu.
Hey, Alex. We are also joined by food writer and chef, Rosie. How are you doing?
Hello.
So microwaves are our first appliance on the show.
Yeah, been waiting a long time to do some kit.
Rosie, as a professional chef, are you a massive microwave snob? Like Gordon Ramsay, you don't like to see anyone using the microwave. It's a cheat method.
Quite the contrary,
Alex. I don't know why I'm baiting you like this.
I think microwaves are brilliant. I honestly do. I find it quite difficult when I'm like, oh, just stick it in the microwave to someone. They're like, I don't have one. I'm like, oh what do you do then?
Quite a few people don't have microwaves.
If you don't have a toaster or a kettle, in my head, it's like on a par with kitchen essentials.
Mm. Totally. When I was training as a home economist, when you're ordering for a big setup for a big TV show, for example, you're working from a, you know, garage in Croydon or something, and you have to order in all your own kitchen equipment and rent it. And I was working for a guy called Rob. He was like, never forget to get a microwave. They are so important for so many different reasons, especially in food television.
It is literally, if you had to explain it to someone, it's a magic box that makes things hot. Because even the oven, you understand, like, the oven gets hot, so therefore the food inside it gets hot, how the toaster works and how the kettle works. But the microwave genuinely seems like magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a lot more intuitive than you think. If you understand how it works, you understand how to use it better. Mm-hmm. And maybe hopefully today that's something we can give to you all. Right?
Ooh, a little teaser.
Well, I don't know.
I'm producing now, are we, Rosie?
I'm assuming we're going to cover how it works.
A big problem with the microwave is its perception. Yeah. There is a lot of cultural snobbery. Like, there's no snobbery of using a toaster, but there's definitely this sense that you're not cooking something properly if you cook it in the microwave. In previous years for QI, I have done taste tests of, say, making a cup of tea in the microwave versus the kettle. Mm-hmm. We'll love to say, make tea or coffee in the microwave or reheat it wherever, it's horrible. It is not possible to tell, you know, a heat from the microwave and heat from the oven on many occasions. And I do think that the iconic moment in 2020, was it? When Nigella referred to it as a microwave, has gone some way to, I think that's the rebrand we need. We need to make it sound exotic and European and classy.
I think the one of the problems around the PR, you know, of microwaves is that they became popular at the same time as convenience foods.
Yes, definitely.
So snobbery around those foods extended to the microwave, and it basically made them look like they were one and one, hand in hand. They couldn't be separated.
And they came straight into the home and were associated with the breaking down of tradwifery and women slaving away to make a three-course meal for their husband when they come back to work in the 1950s. It kind of went hand in hand with that kind of liberation slash degradation of moral values, depending on which side of the spectrum you are. It's seen as this is a lazy way to cook, which I hope is a myth we're going to dispel today.
We stan the microwave. We stan you, Nigella. We are 100% here for you.
Should we start by talking about the microwave as in the wavelength, the frequency which the microwave oven is named after?
Yes, yes.
On the electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
It's a specific part of it. And this very specific part that we tend to use for microwaves is around 2.45 gigahertz.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You can also think about it in terms of like length. So microwaves are a wavelength that's anything between 1 millimeter and a meter. And then the type of length that we're using in the microwave oven is about 12.2 centimeters.
On the smaller end of the microwaves. Mm-hmm. I read that that's why, so when you look through a microwave window, it's got loads of little holes, like it's almost like a fence with loads of holes in. And the size of those holes is really important.
Yeah.
They are big enough that they allow light waves to get through so we can see what's going on inside. Mm-hmm. But they're too small for microwaves to fit through.
Right.
Literally, the wavelength of the microwave is longer than, is longer. As you said, it was about 1.2 millimeters?
Between 12.2 centimeters.
12.2 centimeters. Mm-hmm. So they can't get through, so it's safe to look through.
I really thought it was just a design choice.
Oh, no. That thing is keeping you safe.
Right.
The microwave oven technology was kind of discovered by accident during research into radar during the Second World War. Radar uses microwaves in a really simple way. So you send microwaves out through the air, and when they hit solid objects, they bounce back like an echo, exactly like an echo. And then your equipment interprets those echoes and is able to kind of form an image by interpreting that data. So it's actually kind of a really simple concept. In the 1940s, there were lots of people working on the development of radar and experimenting with microwave technology. Mm-hmm. There was one guy in particular called Percy Spencer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, American physicist Percy Spencer.
He's absolutely amazing. He had no formal education beyond grammar school. Mm. And he was this like self-taught kind of genius
just
in electronics.
Big nerd. Massive nerd. So the story goes that he's working for a company called Raytheon, which was experimenting with electromagnetic technology. And then in his free time, he loves feeding the squirrels in his local park. So he's always carrying like peanut bars with him to work. So when he leaves, he can like go feed wildlife. And whilst he's working with these microwaves, he realizes that the peanut bar in his pocket has started to melt. And he's like, oh my God. Anyway, so that's the story. But it's more likely he's been intentionally experimenting with microwaves and food for a really long time. He's the first person to make microwave popcorn. This is one of the first foods that he's like, oh my God, hold on a second, grabs loads of kernels. And then he starts feeding people in his office with this like microwaved popcorn, which is really cool.
Also, he tried to cook eggs. Which exploded.
I was going to say that's dangerous.
Yeah, so that's how he worked out that it was the water that was being heated.
He developed like the first microwave for cooking food, but it was enormous. It was like 6 foot tall, insanely heavy. So it was really cool, but it wasn't like commercially viable.
Sounds like it was going to microwave people.
Yeah, well, it was really high energy as well. It was like big and dangerous. Yeah, he was kind of a prolific scientist, inventor, and he worked for years for Raytheon, and he developed all sorts of technologies and filed dozens of patents. Do you know how much he got paid when he filed the patent for the microwave?
Oh, I hope it's loads.
It wasn't, was it? It was like 70 quid.
$2.
Oh,
stop.
Which is, I think, about $35 now in today's money, which is still nothing. That was just the company policy because he worked for the company. And so anything he developed was the company's property.
He's never ever been able to cash that in.
No, he never made huge amounts of money from it. I think he did fine overall in his life because he was actually a prolific inventor. But he's not like the billionaire behind the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't live in a huge glass square house with a revolving floor that's really warm so inside. So he filed the first patent in 1945, and then slowly they developed the microwave into a product which started out massive. But a couple of were installed on warships and in big industrial factories. And then it started getting a little bit smaller. You could buy a wall installed version for like kind of a few tens of thousands of dollars. So they were still like a really big, expensive, like I suppose like a top range stove, proper kit. And then 1967 was the countertop revolution. Probably still about the size of a large microwave today.
The countertop revolution sounds like something they would have made up on like Shopping Channel.
Yeah.
It's the countertop revolution.
It's a good way to describe a microwave. Like, that's what they do. They sit on the countertop and revolve.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it is a revolve. Yeah, they were right.
So this was when they managed to actually like build a microwave to be safe and not like leak microwaves and to be like convenient to use. And so that's when sales started climbing dramatically. And to be honest, the design of the microwave hasn't really changed that much since then because they're so simple. I think the microwaves of the 1970s look a lot like the microwaves today, 50 years later, which is pretty amazing.
And rare for appliances and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. Spencer, he died in 1970. So actually, he didn't really see the microwave get super, super popular. No. He saw it kind of on the verge.
He didn't see the fall from grace it had either when pot noodles were invented.
It was really sweet. I was watching a documentary on microwaves, and his grandson is so proud of him when he's taught. I think it is his grandson.
He would be, because like that is a genuinely life-changing invention.
So should we crack in?
Let's do it.
Time for our first lunchbox, and that is Manu. What have you got for us?
I have a beautiful plate of marshmallows.
Something's happened there.
I'd say about half of the plate is raw, and the other half is molten.
It's cool, isn't it?
And did you cook these in the microwave, I assume?
Yes, I did. So I cooked them in the microwave, but I removed a key component from the microwave to do this.
Okay.
Basically, I cooked them with no spinning plate.
Oh, so that's why they're so uneven.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So should we talk about how the microwave works?
Yes.
Burnt marshmallow.
Is it good?
Really good.
Nice. So the spinning plate is my favorite bit of the microwave. I'd never thought about it before, but I watched a really nice documentary by Hannah Fry on microwaves in her series The Secret Genius of Modern Life.
Mm-hmm.
And she breaks apart the microwave, literally breaks apart the microwave in the documentary. And one of the bits she looks at is the spinning plate. Okay, so just to quickly explain how the microwave works, the bit that's creating the electromagnetic waves is called the cavity magnetron. And that sends the waves into the center of the box, which is surrounded by a Faraday cage, which basically stops the electromagnetic waves from getting out. So if you put your mobile in the microwave, you can't call it. Like, none of the waves from a phone outside the microwave is going to get to the phone on the inside of the microwave.
Oh, I did not know that. That's so clever. Yeah.
And the way that these electromagnetic waves work is they jiggle the water molecules in your food. So it excites the water molecules so much that like friction builds between them and the other molecules in the food, and that heats it up. That's why it's so much quicker than a conventional oven, because like the oven is heating the air around your food and it has to penetrate from the outside inwards, whereas a microwave is like creating all of this jiggle right in the food.
Which is why you're always on microwave instructions told to microwave something, let it stand for a bit, microwave it again, because it's a mixture of like patches of your food get heated up, the wet areas of food get heated up. Then you've got to let that heat convect into other areas, because that's also why your bowls sometimes get hot, even though they've not got any moisture in. It's just the bits of your food get incredibly hot. If they're near the bowl, then the bowl gets really hot. So we've got this box. We've got this cavity magnetron. It's generating microwaves and it's shooting them into the empty bit where we put the food.
Exactly.
But it's not able to heat up all of those different areas in that space the same.
The way that the box works is it sends waves that can like cancel each other out. So if you imagine a wave on the sea.
So like if two waves hit each other and one is at the high point of the wave and the other one is at the low point, they sort of cancel each other out to make a flat ocean.
It's like a standing wave. Yeah. So there's no heat coming from that bit of the microwave. You get bits that are being super, super heated, and then bits that are completely raw. And then in the 70s, this is part of the reason they become like commercially viable. Someone realized, hold on a second, let's put a turntable in it. Like, you know, like turntables for music.
DJs.
Exactly. Yeah. It looked so similar to that.
I bet they had the idea at a nightclub.
Oh,
and we're like, I've got to get back to the office.
They probably had like four tabs of LSD and we're like, hang on a second.
So it was in the 70s, these two guys called Gary Mandel and Peter Jurgensen. So they were working in a factory that was making vulcanized rubber. So the stuff that you use for tires and like Wellington boots. And they were using microwaves in their factory to heat up the rubber and the chemicals that like gave it these special properties. But their stuff was catching fire too, because they were getting these hot spots in the factory. So in the factory they had to keep putting out all of these fires, and these two guys were like, hold on a second, if we rotate
between fires, they were like, we've got to do something about this.
So they were like, if we rotate the rubber as it's heating, it would like mitigate the problem of these cold spots and these hot spots. But they realized, like, hold on, this would be even more useful if we put it in a microwave oven. So they went and did like years of research, like pulled all of their money, big passion project, and then they got the patent for it, and it was like snapped up instantly, and they actually made a decent amount of money. So in the documentary, Hannah Fry interviews Gary Mandel, who's one of the inventors, and it said like it really changed his family's life. They were able to like build a home. It was a really lovely story. And yet then in the 1980s, companies started building microwaves with inbuilt turntables. So the ones that we recognize today, you know, they've got the little notch in the bottom and then the bit that fits on top. So yeah, that's my favorite thing about the microwave, is without this like actually quite simple idea, we could not cook our food evenly, which is bonkers.
Wow, it's crazy to think that it wasn't there to begin with, because it's clearly pretty fucking crucial.
It is. It's essential. You can still buy it today, like the original turntable. So it's like just a little platform. It literally looks like a DJ turntable that you put into the microwave.
Yeah. Well, even though these were incorrectly and improperly prepared, I've enjoyed eating them so far.
I am that. No, you know what? I like the burnt bits.
As you said, like the microwave is built, it is a Faraday cage. So the microwaves can't get out. Mm-hmm. And even if a tiny, tiny amount get out, they're like well within the safe range. And actually, you are exposed to more electromagnetic waves from your phone than you are your microwave, even if you were standing right next to your microwave.
Yeah.
So microwaves don't use ionizing radiation. So like X-rays do, microwaves don't. So they don't carry enough energy to detach electrons from atoms.
And that's the thing that causes cancer.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's how you're damaging DNA. You're breaking chemical bonds.
Mm.
So... yeah, microwaves, the electromagnetic wave, are actually so big that they don't fit through the little tiny holes in the window, as I explained.
Yeah.
They're also big enough that if you put some ants in a microwave, the ants theoretically can survive. They're basically because they are too small and too dry. So first of all, the microwaves are big enough that they just pass by the ant.
Mm.
Second of all, the ant can just walk and find a cool space in the microwave because they cook unevenly. And thirdly, the ants don't really have enough moisture in them to be affected. So actually, they're kind of okay in the microwave.
Mm.
Don't do it. Don't put ants in the microwave. You know,
I don't think there's any danger of me putting ants in my microwave. I'd be too scared of what the smell could be like if you accidentally nuked an ant. Wouldn't be nice.
Crispy.
I think there was something in the Hannah Fry documentary that I loved so much. It was like super futuristic microwaves that cook different food items simultaneously to like different temperatures.
Well, like an AI one, they can see what food is in the microwave and then send different strengths of microwaves to different patches.
Exactly. So you can put your meal in, cook all of these different components at the same time at different temperatures, take it out. It's perfectly done.
That's clever.
It's madness.
Yeah, because now also there's like different functions on a microwave. To be honest, I don't really use them as much as I should, but like...
nobody does. But a lot of those settings are quite rarely used, but there are two reasons why we have them. Is A, it's like your classic kind of consumer psychology that if you want to sell a product that looks premium, put loads of different options on it, make it seem like there's a whole world of microwaving for you to do, and you've got all the options, and it's more options than the one next to it on the shelf. You can have a little starburst that says 50 different cooking options, because we're all idiots, we'll buy that, even though all we're ever going to do is turn it on and off. And the second thing is because microwaves now are very, very cheap. The margins are pretty slim. Developing a new microwave is not like something you're going to pour millions into. And so companies will reuse the same button layout or software. Mm. And so they will just take whatever was their best luxury one that they paid to make 10 years ago. They'll just continue to use that in their standard microwaves for the next 10 years. And so you end up with all of these like cook a turkey from live and like radish defrost. Like what is
that? Yeah, I think that's part of the problem is some of the images that they pick are like really misleading as well. Why is there a picture of an ice cream? Like what am I supposed to do with that?
Ruin a child's day.
So I learned something that I didn't know. I want to caveat this firstly by saying, do not do this at home.
Mm.
But one of the famous hazards with a microwave is that you should not put metal in it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, you can put metal in a microwave. In fact, there is metal in the microwave.
Oh yeah, the microwaves are made of metal. Why isn't my microwave exploding?
This is because flat, smooth pieces of metal, they simply reflect the radiation. So the walls of the oven make it bounce around and theoretically enable more omnidirectional, even cooking, in theory. With that in mind, technically a flat piece of metal should be fine in the microwave. If you have ever had the misfortune of putting metal in the microwave, which I have, but usually because it's accidentally on the vintage plates that I insist on putting everything on. Quite a lot of them have like gold foil like stuff on them. What happens is that electromagnetic waves can cause electrons in metal to oscillate, And when those electrons encounter the sharp edges in the metal,
yeah,
they can build up and they create a concentrated electric field.
Oh, like a massive charge. Okay.
Yeah. And then this can cause the air around the metal to become ionized, ooh, which is what then causes a spark.
This so is can... lightning. This is how lightning works. Yeah.
I have somehow watched a lot of movies recently where people have killed other people by putting something metal in the microwave.
Causing a house fire.
Causing the house fire. Yeah.
It's like, a good quick way to do it,
it's the perfect crime.
Because it's right there, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. Okay, time for our second lunchbox, and that is Rosie.
Yes, and I have done something which, you know, a lot of people will not expect from me. I, Rosie McKean, the pasta queen, mm-hmm, have cooked a pasta dish in the microwave.
Whoa.
We did it. We broke Rosie.
No, can I also tell you something?
Stupid podcast has ruined her.
This is not my first time cooking pasta really? In the microwave. I've had to cook pasta in the microwave before, and I realised that it actually works pretty well.
Whoa.
But how dire was the circumstance in which you did it the first time? Were you like...
Well, actually, yes, it was.
A polar research centre with, like...
No, it was actually... I used to be a food stylist for a well-known... ready-to-eat pasta brand, shall we say. And I was food styling for them, and the shoots that they had us do were always in the basement of their locations in central London. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have stoves. And so I would usually bring my induction stoves.
Mm.
But one particularly bad day when I'd also got a flat tire on the way in, I forgot my stoves. And I realized this when I was there, and I was like, how am I going to cook all this pasta? Like, so I boiled the pasta in the microwave.
Whoa.
And it worked perfectly.
That's so cool.
This is a lovely looking proper pasta dish.
Yeah,
it's pasta, tomato, sausage, olives.
This is a recipe from a book called Microwave Meals, and it's by a chef called Tim Anderson, who I have really rated for a really long time. Tim won MasterChef in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So that is quite a long time ago, and I was an avid MasterChef watcher at the time, and I loved his series because he basically is a specialist in American and Japanese cooking. He speaks Japanese, he's spent a lot of time there.
He came up a lot in the microwave research, actually. I think he's now like one of the major names in microwave
cooking.
Well,
exactly. Yeah. And Tim now has written lots and lots of cookbooks, and it's just a really great voice in food media in the UK. So this is his recipe for sausage and peppers penne. I actually use rigatoni. Sorry, Tim. That was just...
Gotta put your stamp on it.
Because what I had.
Original Rosie McKean pasta recipe, everybody. She changed something.
So sausage and peppers is a classic Italian-American preparation where basically sausages are cooked with lots of peppers and onions and nice things. Tim's recipe here is basically like an all-in-one pasta dish. You put everything in the bowl at the start and you microwave it for 24 minutes and it comes out looking like this. Like,
amazing.
You know,
it looks perfect. Nerd,
yeah.
It looks perfect, apart from the fact that it's in a Pyrex bowl.
Yes.
So let's try it, shall we?
Yeah.
Oh,
the sausage is lovely.
Whoa.
Yeah, so you actually cook a whole sausage in there.
Whoa.
Which is clever.
The pasta is great. Oh my God. Honestly, like, why do we spend so much money kitting out our kitchens with ovens and hobs and things? Like,
well, good question. I mean, I think microwaves, as we know, work best with water, which does mean that like there is a certain limitation on what they can do.
Yeah.
The most typical thing that a chef wants to do in any given circumstance is browning, and microwaves are not as good for browning. You can brown things, you just need to have like plenty of oil and you need to have plenty of time.
Okay.
But you wouldn't be able to brown a steak. Like, that's just not possible.
Time the fourth dimensional, time the seasoning.
Time the sort of construct around how the days work. And Tim talks a lot about browning in his book and how it's quite a chefy, arrogant thing to be like, everything has to be browned. In fact, I also think it's quite a Western thing. I remember going to culinary school and I was trained in French food, and it was like every single recipe, everything you built in a pan involved some browning. And yes, flavor is great when you brown, but there are other ways to get that flavor without using that technique. And I actually didn't really sort of learn that or appreciate that until I was able to step away from French style cookery and learn about other different styles. And even in Italian food, like ragu, some ragus, you don't brown the meat at all. You just chuck it in.
Whoa.
You don't brown it. And in African food or West Asian food, you might not brown meat at all. You might boil it before you stew it, for example. So Tim posits that if you're addicted to browning, you aren't seasoning your food correctly, because there are literally so many other techniques ingredients that enable us to create umami flavor without using browning, and that microwaves are the victim of this notion that you can't do stuff in them when actually you can do loads of stuff. In his book, he's got like carbonara recipe, he's got baking. It's a really, really cool modern take on microwave cooking. As I said, he's like an expert in Japanese food. So in Japan, the kitchens are really small, right? Like their space is at a premium. So using appliances is really, really key to a lot of home cooking. And that's why microwaves are actually used a lot more effectively over there, and also in Asia in general, I would say.
And again, it's not even just at home. It's like anyone who's out on the road, anyone who like lives in a camper van or like living on like an Arctic research base or anything like this. Like the idea that you actually have to eat like shit because you don't have access to a proper kitchen
isn't true. And also, I think we are, especially in Western food, hung up on very trad cooking techniques like French. I think you've said on the pod before, but in Chinese cookery, for example, there's a real texture element about like flabby or sort of like chewy things that we would never, ever get because it's never something we've grown up eating. But they're way more open to that, and they therefore use the kit around that, like microwaves or rice cookers or whatever, like, to sort of steam things really slowly. And it's just a little bit of a snobbery thing in food in general that people are funny about microwaves. I think one of the things that also is the downfall of the microwave is that there's no romance to this. There's no like lovely pan. It doesn't look sort of nice. You're missing that feeling of like standing there stirring.
Also the smell. Like that's one of the lovely things about cooking on the stove is.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting that that is just so important to some people. Like they don't feel like they've cooked properly.
It's the same romance as like, I love to go get my McDonald's from the restaurant rather than order in, because you don't get that sound of the beeping, people shouting out numbers. And every McDonald's that has its own like terroir.
2 a.m. Brixton Mackey's. There's nothing like it.
Whereas like the one by Charing Cross is a fucking war zone. You're like physically thrown in and out of the restaurant. There are people like passed out, covered in ketchup in the corner. It's great.
There is, however, a growing movement around microwaves becoming more popular with like proper chefs. Like work in restaurants use microwaves in their restaurants. Chefs, they offer something that humans and ovens and stoves can't, which is consistency. Once you've got the hang of a recipe in the microwave, you can make something extremely consistently every single time. And that's really helpful in a restaurant service, because you can just be like, okay, checks on. I know that in 3 minutes, my salmon mousse is going to be puffed up and ready to go and popping in the microwave. Marco Pierre White famously loves his microwave. He was the youngest chef ever to get 3 Michelin stars. So he is extremely well known, certainly in this country. And he swears by them. He said in his restaurant that they used to cook their veal kidney dish in the microwave to start with. They would also cook marrow bones in there, fish tureen, all those sorts of things.
Fish in the microwave, what a crime. Sorry, like, you know that that's the worst thing that for a microwave.
In the office, that's the worst thing you can possibly do.
And we haven't even talked about the energy efficiency as well. So much more energy efficient to cook in the microwave.
It is massively beneficial cooking, for example, pasta. I used 250ml of water in this recipe for 200 grams of pasta.
That's really good.
If you put that in a pan, you wouldn't cover the pasta.
Just on power, did you know that the clock on the microwave that tells you the time probably uses more power in the lifetime of a microwave than the actual microwave
really
does? Yeah, so a typical clock draws about 2 to 4 watts of power continuously. In a year, that's probably around 30 kilowatt hours per year.
Okay.
And if you use a microwave, say, 2 minutes a day, that's 2.2 kilowatt hours a year. So way less than the clock.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Just want to say on this pasta dish of Tim's that it is really, really good.
It's like, delicious. You'd never be able to tell it was
I wouldn't say this was cooked in the microwave.
So just whilst we're talking about incredible microwave cookbooks, have you guys heard of The World's Saddest Cookbook?
Is it Good Time Cooking by Rosie McKean?
No, so it's called Microwave Cooking for One. Not that long ago, it kind of went completely viral. But it was written in the 80s by a woman called Mary Autair Smith. And people refer to her as like the Vincent Van Gogh of cookbooks, because she died before her book became famous and before basically she moved around a lot because her husband was in the army, and she had to learn how to cook for just herself when like all of her kids left home and her husband was away. And using the microwave was like a really useful tool for her to cook meals for one quickly and not take that much time. And then she spent 10 years recipe developing for this book. And she used to like go into women's centers and teach other people how to cook as well using the microwave and like really simple ingredients, making like American classics actually really well. So I watched a video of her from the 80s and she cooks like an entire American breakfast, like actually browns the bacon as well.
Yeah, you can brown bacon in the microwave.
It's really impressive.
This isn't sad at all, Manny. Well, you misled us.
I mean, I think the title is because there's so many cultural associations between like microwave speed cooking and like singledom or kind of, it's not the sexiest.
I found a book by the same name, but by a different author, Annette Yates, Microwave Recipes for One.
Yeah.
On eBay. And again, I bought it because I thought it looked quite funny and sad. Mm-hmm. Actually flipping through it and reading the introduction, it's kind of similar. You're like, hang on a second. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great idea. Like, it makes cooking more accessible and like it's more flexible. And if you've got different dietary requirements in your family, if everyone eats at different times, usually that just means everyone eats badly. But this means that you can actually cook loads of different meals well and like give variety. It's, and like there's some good stuff in there.
It's super cool.
This is my gift to you, Ruth.
Thank you. But, I really enjoy the food styling on the front. It's
really
perfect.
Pretty.
Time for our third and final lunchbox this week, and that is me. And I have made a classic microwave concoction from the height of COVID madness, a mug cake.
Yum!
Remember these guys?
Always wanted to try one of these. I've never done it before.
I think we might be the last three people on earth who've never made one. I made my first one last night. I was genuinely astonished. The whole concept is put a small amount of every cake ingredient, so like self-raising flour and an egg and some cocoa powder and a little bit of vanilla extract, some chocolate chip stuff, into a mug, mix it up, stick it in the microwave for 90 seconds. I was like, bullshit, this sounds like TikTok nonsense. And it genuinely makes like a hot chocolate kind of thing. So let's dig in and try.
All right.
Okay. Oh my god,
very moist.
It's so much more like cakey than I actually thought it was going to be.
The texture is amazing. Yeah.
Listen, considering that that took 90 seconds, the science of that is impressive to me.
So first of all, I mean, this might be old news to everyone else who has been eating mug cakes for years. I brought this in because it represents some of the weird shit we did with microwaves, especially in the COVID era. People put a lot of stuff in microwaves that really shouldn't have been put in there. So for example, one of the things that microwaves can do is it's very good at sterilizing things because it heats up the water, kills all of the microbes. So you can put a sponge, like a dirty sponge you've been cleaning with, in the microwave.
Oh, and it can
kill a lot of the microbes on it. It's not necessarily totally foolproof, but it's a good way of cleaning a sponge.
Nice.
People have taken this principle and tried to sterilize other things in microwaves. So there was a library in Florida that had to warn its patrons during COVID not to microwave its books. Because not because it didn't work, because actually it can dry out books. And actually it's a great way if a library's experienced a flood. Often they will use microwaves to dry out their books. The problem is that a lot of books these days have RFID tags in them, which will have metal in and will set fire to the books. So don't put your books in the microwave, kids. There was also the resurgence of a great fake Apple ad. I don't know if you remember this. I think it originated in about 2013, but it came back during COVID, that suggested there was a new feature on Apple iPhones and you could put your iPhone in the microwave on like 20 seconds and it would like fully charge it. And obviously it does not do that.
Did people actually...
loads of metal that would like...
No, your phone immediately stops working, basically. So I was looking at weird things that microwaves get used for, and I came across this other story, which was during... this was before the invention of microwaves. Before I tell this story, this is about an experiment that happened in the 1950s, and there is some considerable animal cruelty in it. So skip ahead if you don't want to hear about that. While Percy Spencer was developing the microwave for like domestic cooking uses, completely independently, a scientist called James Lovelock, who is a very famous now British scientist, he's an inventor. He came up with this thing called the Gaia hypothesis, which is the idea that the Earth functions as like a one big organism. And that's a really interesting way to view it. He was one of the last of the independent scientists who wasn't really tied down to one particular area of science, but invented loads of interesting things, came up with lots of interesting theories. Amazing guy. In the 1950s, he was working for a rather weird medical research council. Seattle, and they were exploring ways to preserve life, monitor life, experiment with life. And this is not very humane, but one of the ways they were doing it was that they were freezing live hamsters. So they were frozen solid, so you could like whack them on the table, and then trying to heat them up again and reanimate them.
What, like, it's alive? Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly. So they'd stop breathing, their hearts would stop pumping, totally rock solid hamsters.
Fully just put them in the freezer.
Did it work?
So basically the problem was heating them back up again, because you need to defrost them gently and evenly, and they were using these little hot plate heater things and they were burning parts of the hamster and it wasn't really working. Anyway, he came up with the idea of, he sort of knew the military were using this microwave technology, and he thought, well, maybe that will work. So he basically rigged up a sort of makeshift equivalent of the modern microwave without really realizing what he was inventing, and successfully managed to reanimate a large number of hamsters by microwaving them back to life from freezing. They would get up and walk around.
There was one rat that they froze and thawed 10 times, the same rat. It's mad.
So they were doing it to rats too?
Yeah.
What the hell?
There's actually an amazing video. I got this from a Tom Scott video. Tom actually went and interviewed James Lovelock.
That's so cool.
Only a few years ago, because he lived to 101. So he only died a few years ago. And Tom interviewed him and got the first-hand account of how this works. It's amazing. Absolutely incredible. So yes, animal cruelty aside, remember this was the 1950s. Unbelievable, like, side note in the invention of the microwave.
Like, honestly crazy. I can't believe they did that. And I can't believe it worked.
But it is really cool. It actually had a practical application for tissue preservation. So say with organ donation and stuff, you want to be able to like keep things for a really long time and then heat them back up to like a usable temperature.
And then way off in the future, the idea of interstellar travel and being able to preserve humans in some way and then wake them up in hundreds of years after they've traveled.
Like Dr. Evil in Austin Powers.
And there'll be a book on microwave reanimation for one. Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
And we will leave you with this. Since the 1990s, the Parkes Observatory in New South Wales, Australia, one of the world's premier radio telescopes, had been detecting strange short bursts of radio waves known as peritons. These signals were puzzling astronomers because they resembled a rare and powerful emission believed to come from far-off galaxies. After years of wondering, in 2015, they finally realized that the peritons were caused not by deep space phenomena, but by their colleagues using the microwave in the observatory canteen.
Oh, that's got a sting.
Furious.
And they were cooking fish. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Onryo, Rosie McKean, and produced by me, Alex Bell. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee. This has been a quite interesting podcast.